It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi. It's Wednesday, February 6. Today on the podcast, the gun debate at the state capitol. Campaign finance officials want tougher disclosure laws. Some lawmakers want more school lunches paid for. And we hear about a potential alternative energy breakthrough in Pine River. Well, it's day two of hearings at the state capitol on regulating guns. Passions are high on both sides of the debate. Yesterday, DFL lawmakers presented several gun control bills, and Madeline Barron says many in the audience were against.
Outside the hearing room, members of a group called the Minnesota Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance ran a brisk business selling T-shirts to gun supporters. Inside, many testified the state doesn't need more restrictions on guns. Jim Schultz suggested that lawmakers were blaming responsible gun owners for murders and other gun violence.
Do you feel that you need to punish me for what has happened elsewhere? Would you like me to go to jail for the little girl in Minneapolis who was paralyzed by a stray gang bullet? We need to focus your perspective on finding and fixing criminals.
The audience at the hearing of the House Public Safety Committee listened quietly for the most part. But there was a brief burst of applause when Republican Representative Tony Cornish of Vernon Center said he would introduce an amendment allowing school teachers and staff to carry guns. And he offered his own take on signs posted at schools warning weapons are banned.
Under a new sign, I would say you are now entering a killing zone. Run, run, run.
DFL lawmakers presented several bills last night. One was a proposal to increase penalties for people known as straw buyers, who buy guns on behalf of people who are forbidden from purchasing them. Another bill would make filing a false report of a lost or missing firearm a more serious crime. Supporters of the legislation say it will give law enforcement more power to go after illegal gun trafficking networks. The proposal has the backing of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, says the group's executive director, Jim Franklin.
When somebody does something egregious, we should answer for that and hold them accountable, and we think that this does that.
Tim Bender, a deputy sheriff for Beltrami County, testified against the bills. Bender said he was at the hearing to express his own views, not those of the county. He said lying to police or buying guns for someone else isn't the same as committing a violent crime.
Making a false report should be left where it is, which is a crime against the administration of justice. Otherwise, you know, this would make a person who made a mistake the functional equivalent of a robber or a kidnapper.
Another proposal would create a voluntary registry of people who do not want to be allowed to purchase guns. The bill's author, DFL Representative Ryan Winkler of Golden Valley, says the registry is meant to be used by people struggling with suicidal thoughts. And, he says, if a person realizes it's not safe to possess a gun, law enforcement should have a place to hold that weapon temporarily.
I frankly have more experience with guns than I have with mental illness. And I know that for a lot of people, my family included, guns are family heirlooms. You know, people aren't ready to make long-term decisions necessarily, even though they have a short-term immediate problem. And so this would help get over that hurdle.
Diane Selgren says a voluntary registry could have prevented her daughter's suicide.
Please help me make this one senseless act. Hundreds of senseless acts, or even thousands of senseless acts, mean something so that no parent, no child, no sibling has to hear their loved one is gone, whether the harm is self-inflicted or an act of someone that should not have access to a gun.
Committee Chair DFL Representative Michael Paymar of St. Paul says he expects a vote on the measures by the end of the month.
Madeline Barron on guns. State lawmakers are being asked to require public officials to say more about where they get their money. The Minnesota Campaign Finance Board has voted to encourage the legislature to pass tougher economic disclosure laws. Tom Scheck says a proposal backed by the board would require officials to disclose consulting interests and details about income earned by spouses.
The Minnesota Campaign Finance Board's action doesn't change how public officials disclose their outside income, but their recommendations will carry considerable weight with lawmakers who could make the changes. Board member Neil Peterson, a former Republican House member, said he hopes the board's recommendation will motivate legislators to update a law that hasn't been changed since the 1970s.
Part of our responsibility is to set the bar very high, and that we should come with a bill that has it inclusive and ask the legislature to stretch in its thinking to get to the highest level of integrity we can expect them to get to, because sometimes they simply cannot do it by their process.
The 4-2 vote for the measure came after several months of wrangling as to whether the board should take a position on the disclosure law. Minnesota requires elected officials, commissioners, and other political appointees to file a statement that details their outside income. But the law is littered with loopholes that allow officials to shield income if they are self-employed. An investigation by NPR News found that in many cases, the disclosure forms filed by elected officials provided little, if any, meaningful information about the sources of their outside income. The board's proposal would change that. Any sole proprietor who receives $2,500 or more would have to disclose his or her clients. The overall goal of the change is to give the public a better understanding when public officials have a conflict of interest. Board member Deanna Weiner, a former DFL state senator, also voted for the plan.
I think the public's waiting for it. I think the legislature's waiting for it. And they're looking for a framework to start with.
The board is also recommending that public officials be required to disclose the financial interests of their spouses and children under the age of 18. That measure worried board chair Andy Luger. The Minneapolis attorney said he worries it could have unintended consequences.
You don't want people deciding not to take on these kinds of positions because it would then require disclosure of private matters of a spouse.
But board member George Beck said spousal income does make a difference.
The economic welfare of my wife is a matter of great concern to me, and I think it'd be appropriate to include spouses in the statute. I don't know how you overlook that if you're making a public decision.
Campaign finance board officials will now submit their plan to the legislature and will lobby for its passage. The committee chairs who deal with elections issues in the legislature say it's likely they'll pass tighter economic disclosure requirements this session. DFL Representative Steve Simon of St. Louis Park chairs the House Elections Committee.
This is a significant effort on the part of the board to give guidance to the legislature. It doesn't mean that we're going to swallow it whole, but it does mean that we're going to carefully consider the recommendations.
Simon, an attorney, says he believes the board should have required attorneys to disclose more as well. He said there are ways for them to say more about how they earned their money without violating their ethical codes of conduct. A spokeswoman for Governor Dayton says the governor also supports the concept of requiring public officials and candidates to disclose more about their outside income.
Tom Scheck there on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. The legislative auditor says under current law, he cannot assess a complaint against two state officials. Tim Pugmire has more on that.
Republican lawmakers accuse Secretary of State Mark Ritchie and Human Rights Commissioner Kevin Lindsay of wrongly using public resources last year to campaign against the two proposed constitutional amendments. Legislative auditor Jim Nobles launched an inquiry and concluded that Minnesota does not have a clear standard to assess those actions. Nobles said the legislature would need to clarify the issue in state law. Nobles received a response from Ritchie in which he denied working against the voter ID amendment, but his office spent $28,000 on materials related to the amendment and responding to citizens. Lindsay, however, said he used public resources to oppose voter ID and the amendment to ban same-sex marriage, and he declared that it was his job to do so. His department spent at least $6,000 on that opposition.
Tim Pugmire at the state capitol. Thousands more Minnesota kids would get free school lunches if bills become law. Here's Julie Seipel to tell us how.
About 60,000 Minnesota students qualify for lunch at a reduced price. For 40 cents a day, they get, for example, a turkey burger, sweet potatoes, fruit, and vegetables. But advocates for low-income families say even that 40 cents can be too much to pay.
There is a risk that these kids don't have the money for lunch.
Jessica Webster is an attorney for Legal Aid. Her group looked at what happens if a student on reduced price lunch comes to school without money. It found that in some lunch lines, kids can't get a meal.
We found that about 20% of districts do have a policy of turning a child away with nothing. It looks different in a lot of districts. Some days you'll get a peanut butter sandwich for 3 days and then they'll send you away. Some days you'll get crackers and then you get turned away after a week.
Policies vary from place to place.
And it's not always district by district. Sometimes it's school by school or lunch lady by lunch lady. So there are principals that would never have a child turned away. And there are principals that say, look, this is a new reality. We have a lot of funding pressures.
A bill at the legislature aims to change this by expanding free lunch to students who already qualify for reduced-price meals. Bill sponsors estimate the expansion would cost the state $4 million a year. DFL Senator Jeff Hayden of Minneapolis is the bill's chief author. He says school lunch may be the only good meal low-income kids get all day.
And with all of the talk about education and education reform and making sure that our children are prepared to go into society, there's no better way than to make sure that kids get a good quality lunch so that they can learn.
The bill is likely to face some questions. Republican Senator Sean Nenow of Cambridge is the ranking minority member on the Education Finance Committee. He doesn't have a position yet, but Nenow is skeptical of the proposal.
The concern with that is, number one, you're completely disengaging families that, theoretically at least, have a fairly substantial ability to pay something.
A family of four can make up to $42,000 and qualify for reduced price lunch. A family of seven can make $64,000. Nenow says it may be tight, but most of those families probably can pitch in.
If the problem is that we have one or two or 10 or 50 or 100 or 1,000 kids that have a parent that aren't fulfilling their responsibility, well, then let's look at targeting the resources to fix that problem and not spend it on all 60,000 kids.
It's hard to say how many kids get turned away. St. James is one of the districts with a turnaway policy. Superintendent Becky Chalofsky says the district refused just two kids meals last school year after allowing them to run a deficit for many days. The district simply can't feed everyone for free, Chalofsky says. Last year, she wrote off about $2,000 in unpaid lunch debt.
We run a very tight budget. I mean, my budget for this year is like we're showing a $9,000 in the black on the entire year. That means everything has to go perfectly according to plan just to stay in the black and not go into the red. There's just no way that we can continue to pick up things like that out of our general fund.
Still, she's torn about the proposed legislation. She doesn't want the money pulled from other education funds, and she sees a role for families.
I'm all for feeding all the kids, and I think it's a great initiative, but I do also think that there does need to be some accountability on our parents. And, you know, I think the school over time has just continued to take on more and more parental responsibilities. There has to be a line somewhere.
But the change would be welcome news for many nutrition directors and those on the front lines in the lunchrooms. In Brooklyn Center schools, kids used to get sandwiches when they couldn't pay, but district cook manager Sandy Schultz says she wasn't comfortable with that. She wants all kids to eat well.
Whether it's a parent not doing their job or whatever the case may be, somebody's got to care.
Now in Brooklyn Center, if a child shows up without money for lunch, that student can eat anyway. Schultz doesn't yet know what this will do to her budget.
You know, I guess if I lose my job for not coming out in the black, then I guess I lose my job for not coming out in the black.
Senate committee leaders say the proposed legislation will get a hearing, but a date hasn't been set.
Julie Seipel on food in schools. School officials in Rushford, Peterson, and Moose Lake plan to ask the state legislature for help for their flood-damaged schools. Elizabeth Baer reports.
Both districts suffered flood damages in the last 5 years. The districts repaired the damages, and students returned to school. But officials say the fixes are temporary. Moose Lake Superintendent Bob Indahar says taxpayers cannot pay for the entire bill for a new building, but are willing to pay for some of the costs. He says the districts are teaming up this year in hopes of convincing lawmakers for $20 million each to offset part of their rebuilding expense.
We're in cities that are not affluent cities, so to have our taxpayers pay more than someone who isn't an affluent city, I don't know how that's fair.
Indahar says working with Rushford Peterson is his district's only chance of convincing lawmakers to help fund the flood-damaged districts. He says both districts have the support of their local legislators.
That's Elizabeth Baer. The St. Paul police officer photographed last year in a culturally insensitive costume has issued an apology. Curtis Gilbert reports.
In a police department press release, Officer Robert Booth said the photo was taken at a private Halloween party on his personal time. The statement said he looked forward to repairing any damage that may have been caused. The image shows Booth dressed as a Muslim woman, wearing makeup, a red headscarf, and a name tag bearing the Target logo. Booth occasionally worked off-duty providing security at a Twin Cities Target store. Police Chief Tom Smith said in a statement he considered the apology sincere, but the department is still conducting an internal investigation into the matter, which could include disciplinary action. Booth has been with the department almost 13 years. The photo was first posted online in November and came to the police department's attention after Somali American activists discovered it on Twitter over the weekend. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A survey by the University of Minnesota Tourism Center offers some good news for the state's leisure and hospitality industry. Martin Moylan has more.
Center Director Ingrid Schneider says most Minnesotans are looking forward to enjoying vacations and other relaxing breaks within the state this year.
The majority of Minnesotans plan to spend as much or more on leisure travel as they did in 2012.
Among respondents surveyed toward the end of last year, 48% said they plan to spend the same amount on leisure travel this year as they did last year. 19% expected to spend more. The state estimates the tourism industry generates nearly $12 billion in annual sales in Minnesota and accounts for close to a quarter million jobs. Tourism also produces about $750 million in sales taxes. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A Minnesota company is using a $3 million grant on a pilot project to improve care for senior citizens in rural communities. Here's Dan Gunderson with that report.
Ecumen CEO Catherine Roberts says the idea is to build a facility in Detroit Lakes, which will offer services from telemedicine to exercise programs in one location. Roberts says the goal is to help seniors stay healthy and independent longer.
And if going in and using the telehealth center or going in and exercising in the warm water pool keeps me agile enough to remain active, that's really high value. And it keeps me out of a medical crisis, which is also really valuable to me as an individual and saves money to the healthcare system.
Robert says services for the elderly are often fragmented in rural areas, making it more difficult for people to access the programs they need. The new facility will be open sometime next year. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
And finally, we look at a small company in Pine River, Minnesota. It's gambling that a new line of scientific research could lead to development of a breakthrough alternative energy. Hunt Utilities Group sits on a 70-acre campus dotted with an eclectic mix of experimental buildings designed to promote sustainable living. Researchers there are now focused on a theoretical energy source, once commonly known as cold fusion. Tom Robertson says they're asking new questions about a technology widely dismissed by the mainstream scientific community.
Most visits to the company Paul and Lynn Hunt founded begin with a tour of their experimental home.
The actual furnace is down here that heats this 4,000 square foot house. And we turn it on about 1 or 2 days a week in January.
A single element from a water heater sends hot water through pipes in the floor. Heavy insulation and passive solar heat keep the couple's heating costs to less than $50 a month. The Hunt's focus on sustainable living is supported by profits from a wildly successful invention Paul came up with in the 1990s. The self-taught inventor patented something called a turtle meter, which allows utility companies to remotely read electric power meters. Hunt sold his invention for millions. His company is now using the money for research and development, searching for the next breakthrough invention to sustain the company and its 20 employees. That's where cold fusion comes in. The technology was first introduced in 1989 by two scientists who claimed they were able to produce excess heat from an experiment that combined hydrogen and electricity with various metals. When other researchers were unable to consistently replicate the effect, mainstream scientists largely rejected cold fusion. When Paul Hunt first started looking into the technology 2 years ago, he and his son Ryan were skeptical.
Both of us here looked at each other and said, cold fusion? I thought that was dead. I thought that was fake. So we started paying attention to it. And then we started looking at the history of it and found out that it really is real. It's been done in labs all over the world.
That now includes the laboratory at Hunt Utilities Group in Pine River.
And this is the main apparatus right here.
With a degree in chemical engineering from the University of Minnesota, Ryan Hunt is head of research and development at his parents' company. He stands over a pair of small transparent tubes containing ceramic structures that hold pairs of hair-thin wires. Hunt says just last month he and his team achieved the cold fusion effect for the first time. The same unexplainable effect has reportedly been achieved at more than 100 other laboratories worldwide. Most have ditched the term cold fusion in favor of the term low-energy nuclear reactions. Hunt Utilities Group has teamed with scientists in Europe to collaborate. They've been posting their data online and inviting other researchers to comment or critique their methods. Ryan Hunt says the goal is to demonstrate the science well enough to excite other researchers. He believes the technology could potentially heat homes, power cars, and replace coal to produce electricity.
Because the potential upside in the long term is the displacement of all fossil fuels. It would be such a boon for the human race to have such a dense, clean source of energy. You know, real easy to stay motivated on a project like this.
While the federal government isn't investing much resources into the technology, scientists at NASA's research center have begun studies. Benjamin Bayman is an emeritus professor of physics at the University of Minnesota. He doesn't believe the processes that scientists have achieved are nuclear in nature, but Bayman says the science is probably worth pursuing.
There are phenomena going on there that are not properly understood, and so it would be good if we did understand them, and once we do understand them, there may well be some practical applications.
Company founder Paul Hunt is a patient man. He came up with his turtle meter idea 25 years before the device became a reality. He's hoping that low-energy nuclear reactions technology will also result in a long-term payoff. Hunt believes in it enough to invest more than $500,000 a year into research. Tom Robertson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Pine River.
That's the NPR News Update on this Wednesday, February 6th. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for joining me. I'll be back with Minnesota's news on your schedule right here tomorrow.